Got a few questions for you to consider as we talk with our next guest. For example, why is Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak considered one of the most consecrated records in sports history? Why are football coaches afraid of the two-point conversion? Do you need a star to win in the NBA playoffs? There are a lot of sports beliefs out there, and we're going to take a look at them with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way, and on the phone with me today is Sheldon Hirsch. He's a board-certified pediatric kidney specialist and a self-professed sports geek. And his new book is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. You may have a favorite sports myth. I hope you'll call in with your questions, comments, and sharing information at 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email at ideas@wpr.org, or you can also post on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Sheldon Hirsch, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I thought you obviously have a passion for sports, and you talk about that a little bit in the beginning of your book, but tell us how that came about.
Well, like many sports fans, I was born to a dad with a passion for sports, and mine actually goes back as far as 1962, which I can remember one of the most exciting events in baseball history, at least, which was the Yankees-Giants World Series and two outs in the ninth inning of the seventh game, and Willie McCovey hitting a shot that was going to win the game for the Giants but happened to go right at Yankee second baseman Bobby Richardson. Yeah. And that was kind of an awesome introduction to the world of sports. It's been now about 55 years that I haven't missed a World Series game or an NBA Finals game or a Super Bowl.
Oh,
or an issue of Sports Illustrated.
I don't think I've missed an issue of Sports Illustrated either. I've missed a few of those games you talked about, but not very many. Well, would sports be as compelling to you without the statistics part of it?
Well, yes, of course, but I think, I mean, statistics are part of it, especially baseball. I mean, baseball is an inherently numerical game, you know, in terms of how you evaluate players, but also how you tally winners and losers. And I think that, you know, the same is true for the major sports. Now, that said, there's a lot more to the game than statistics. You know, McCovey's line drive going at Richardson and not a foot above or to the side has nothing to do with statistics, but it, you know, it breeds a lifetime of interest in sports. You know, a errant rebound going out to Chris Bosh with 10 seconds left in the game, getting fed to Ray Allen, backing into the corner and hitting a miraculous shot that changes the, you know, NBA Finals champion is the sort of thing that I think attracts lots of us to watching these games. The end of last night's NCAA game, you know, just incredible competition. You know, things like that. But that said, I mean, I think statistics are intrinsic to sports, and you know, you can like them more or less. That's just a personal choice, but I think they're definitely part of it.
I tell you, I really enjoyed reading your book. And these are sports truths, so to speak. How did you get so interested in looking into these so-called sports truths?
Well, I think that sort of it goes back a little bit to who I am in a way. I mentioned my dad. He was a calculus professor, a mathematician, and very obviously that's how I grew up, with numbers, and numbers sort of demand precision. So you really kind of learn to ask how they, you know, fit in or don't fit in. And then it turns out my mother was a debate coach at a local high school. So I grew up learning that, you know, you're supposed to argue with people. And you're but you know, that's said a little bit facetiously, but also that, you know, you learn how to question evidence, question what other people say, develop your own argument. So that was kind of my childhood, mixed in with sports, math, and debating. And then I ended up as a scientist, first a molecular biologist doing DNA work, and then, as you said, I've now been a kidney doctor for many, many years. And one of the things that you learn in science is skepticism. You know, you learn when people tell you things that you don't say okay. You say, well, what's the proof? And you approach that with a healthy skepticism. In medicine, for example, we now know that even the best studies, 30 to 50% of them turn out to be wrong. So I kind of professionally developed this, a skeptical mind and an interest in really looking at what is really the evidence behind something and whether it's sufficient, whether it holds up to close scrutiny. And when you apply that to my first love and greatest love, sports, you know, there's all this lore and all these convictions that lore and sports writers assert as dogma, and some of them are true. But, you know, as you go through them, and then as you're writing a book and every day you're looking at sports events and reading the papers and listening to things and what people say and, you know, evaluating current events as they go by, I try to make the case that you find out that a lot of these things are not really well supported, and that's what constitutes the book.
Yeah, it sure does. And, you know, the baseball season just started. Our Brewers lost yesterday to the Rockies 7-5.
Too early to panic.
Too early to panic. Well, let's take...
Listen, in the New York newspapers, you know, I am from New York, where yeah. They panic. The Yankees lost their first game, and there's panic in the paper. Comical. But that's what I like about the Midwest, is that people are more rooted and less histrionic than from where I come from.
Well, let's talk about DiMaggio's hitting streak. And for those who aren't familiar, give us the background on it.
Well, the background is, I think most sports fans know, he got a hit in 56 consecutive games. We should say that over those 56 games, he hit terrifically by any measure. His batting average was over 400. He had 15 home runs. I mean, it was a great piece of hitting. But what's happened to that 56-game streak is that it has sort of escalated into this Hollywood melodramatic idea put forth by very smart people, Nobel Prize winners even, that it not only was the greatest feat ever in baseball, but that it might have been the greatest feat ever in any sport. So that's what I look at in the book. And again, it clearly was a great piece of hitting, no doubt about that. But actually, it clearly, by any conventional criteria, was surpassed by a number of other 56-game sequences in baseball history. So just to mention a couple, Mickey Mantle hit over 400 with more home runs and a much higher on-base plus slugging percentage in 1956, and Ted Williams did the same in 1957. But the most interesting part of this is that at the exact time DiMaggio was hitting in 56 straight games, he wasn't even the best hitter in baseball. Over that exact same time period, Ted Williams had a higher batting average and a higher on-base plus slugging percentage. But nobody knows that. Nobody remembers it. Nobody even knew it at the time. And nobody remembers Mantle. Nobody remembers Rogers, Hornsby, or George Brett hitting 480 over 56 games. So the question is, what is it about DiMaggio's consecutive game hitting streak that elevates it well above what seem to be superior sequences that we don't even know about? All right, and there's a several-layer discussion in the book, but let me focus on the most important one, because the obvious answer is that DiMaggio's streak is the only one that's consecutive.
Yeah.
So being consecutive is what elevates DiMaggio's streak from completely forgotten to Hollywood ethereal greatness. So now we got to ask ourselves, well, what is the meaning of consecutiveness, and what is it about consecutiveness in DiMaggio's streak that makes it, you know, the be-all and end-all? And let me summarize it this way. In some instances, consecutive actually does something terrific by the interaction between the consecutive events that elevates the whole to much greater than just the sum of the parts. So I'll give you two easy examples. If you see 10 pieces of wood lying on the ground, they're just 10 pieces of wood. But if you bolt them consecutively together, now you have a bridge, and you can walk across a river. So that's where the consecutive nature of those planks really elevates it. Now, to bring it back to baseball, if a team has 9 hits in a game, one per inning, which is kind of like DiMaggio's streak, one hit every inning, they may be shut out, lose the game. But if you have 9 consecutive hits in one inning, you have 7, 8, or 9 runs. That's a fantastic thing. So now if we think about DiMaggio, what's consecutive about DiMaggio's streak? Well, the games are consecutive, but that's irrelevant. But the hits, which is what we're interested in, the hits are not at all consecutive.
No, they're not.
They're separated by outs, by 7 or 8, 5, whatever. They have absolutely no relationship to each other. So to put it together, from the Yankees' point of view, the difference between DiMaggio hitting in 56 straight games and 55, in which case we'd never have heard about it, is one hit in his 223 at-bats.
You know what? We're going to have to take a quick break. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the Packers as well with our guest. You stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking about sports a little bit now. Why is LeBron James so polarizing? Why don't we know what a catch is in football, for goodness sakes? Do hot hands exist? We'll take up those issues today with Sheldon Hirsch. He's a sports geek and by day a pediatric kidney specialist. His new book is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. What sports truths do you wonder about? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Sheldon, we've got Bill on from Madison with a question that I think relates quite well to your book. Let's go there. Bill, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hey, yeah, thank you, Larry. Yeah, being a transplanted Marylander, I got two quick things. One about streaks, one that I think is pretty good in the NFL, Johnny Unitas' consecutive touchdown, I think it's 50-some games in a row. And the other thing is about Sports Illustrated. I think it was maybe the first football game I ever watched was the 63 Western Championship game, and I think Don Chandler of the Green Bay Packers kicked a field goal that I don't think was good, and Sports Illustrated put on their cover some dotted lines, and that's when the NFL raised the goalpost.
Thanks a lot, Bill, for calling. Well, Sheldon?
Bill's as old as I am. I like that. But let me make a comment about the touchdown streak, because it actually relates to DiMaggio. So first of all, Johnny Unitas threw 47 games in a row. He threw a touchdown. That actually was eventually broken not too long ago by Drew Brees, who threw 54 in a row. But here's the interesting thing. A couple years ago, Tom Brady, probably the most famous person in the NFL, had thrown a touchdown pass in 52 consecutive games. He was now in his 53rd game, one game away from the all-time record. And the game went down to the buzzer, and he threw a pass. I don't remember all the details exactly, but I think it was caught on the 1 yard line.
Yeah.
And the game ended. And his streak ended, so he ended 2 games short of the 54 of the record of touchdown consecutive games with a touchdown pass. And the interesting thing is that got virtually zero national attention. Tom Brady is the most famous person in the NFL. The Patriots are a national team. The all-time record for consecutive touchdown passes, consecutive games with a touchdown pass, was right at the brink, and nobody cared. Now compare that to DiMaggio's streak. Imagine if a batter today was in his 54th, had hit in 54 consecutive games, and now was in his 55th. I mean, the whole nation would stop.
Yeah.
Donald Trump would sit there tweeting about it, at bat by at bat.
You're absolutely right. I was thinking back when Paul Molitor played for the Brewers. He had a long streak going, and it wasn't nearly that long, but people started getting interested, really interested in it.
Yes.
Oh, man. Well, I this whole business about passing, and you do have a quite a nice piece on in your book about unitas and comparing unitas to, I think it was a former Badger quarterback, as a matter of fact, who wound up playing in the far west, the Seattle Seahawks. But I want to talk about passing and when is a pass and when is a pass not a pass, because you have some interesting thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, what I talk about is the what I call the catch-no-catch rule. And there have been three or four there've been three or four very famous events in probably in the last 10 years. One was with the Packers.
Yeah.
When it was a 2015 playoff game, Dez Bryant caught a ball in the end zone that everybody thought, it looked like a catch, and then he eventually dropped it, and it was ruled a non-catch. And there were a couple of other similar events like that. Calvin Johnson from Detroit, there was another one, Odell Beckham against the Patriots, in which there were three very important plays that looked to the eyeball like obvious catches that were ruled non-catches. So what became obvious is that we really didn't know what a catch was, which is kind of an incredible thing considering the NFL has been around since 1920 and George Halas and Red Grange, and we're almost 100 years later, and the NFL convenes a committee to try to figure out what a catch is. Now, that's kind of incredible. And what it struck me was that they were making really a very elemental thinking error, something that we commonly talk about in medicine, something that's called Occam's razor. And Occam's razor is Occam was a kind of philosopher about 800 years ago who basically created the or suggested the idea that as a first approximation, the simplest explanation of any event is most likely to be correct. Don't look for complicated things. And the NFL forgot that. So the way the rules read now is really weird stuff. Like, a catch is not a catch until a receiver comes down and makes a football play.
Yeah.
Or makes a, and then they don't even define what a football play. They needless what a football play is. So they basically needlessly complicate the situation. They violate Occam's razor by adding these stipulations to something that really is, if you just take it simply, is pretty straightforward. A catch is a catch if a guy has control of the ball when he comes down to the ground. And what happens afterwards doesn't change that. If he loses control, it's a fumble. And if he loses control after a reception in the end zone, it's a touchdown. So that would be the simplest explanation, and I think that holds. I think what they did was sort of violate another thinking problem, which is a solution to a problem that doesn't exist is not a solution.
Yeah.
We know what a catch is. Why are they trying to solve that problem with all these extra things? And what they did with all this extra commotion is just create a situation where obvious catches in important games are called non-catches, and 100 years later, we're still arguing about what a catch is in convening special conventions.
But Fred in Superior has something about Joe DiMaggio's streak. Fred?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I want to say, gentlemen, who won the batting title the year that Joe DiMaggio had the 56-game winning streak?
Ted Williams.
And what did he hit that year?
Hit 406.
And
the last 400 hitter. And yet DiMaggio won the MVP.
Going into the last day of the season on the 154th game, what was Williams batting?
He was batting 399.6. And rather than 399.8.
Excuse me, he was batting, look it up, he was batting over 400, and his manager was going to sit him out, and he said no, and he either went 2-for-4 or 3-for-5.
Well, he actually went 6-for-8. But if you look it up, the idea that you're mentioning is absolutely right, and that's why Ted Williams was so awesome, that he refused to sit out. But there is a little nuance that's different. Is his average actually was something? It was like 399.6. So rounded up, if he had sat out, it would have been 400. But he refused to sit out, and he went 6-for-8 and ended up at 406, which is the highest average. Nobody's beaten that since, obviously. And yet, because DiMaggio had his consecutive hits, he won the MVP.
Yeah.
Go figure.
All right. Thanks, Fred. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh man! Well, you cover basketball as well in the in your book, and here we have the NCAA men's and women's basketball tournament just ended. Just as a comment, as an aside, besides the UConn upset, were you surprised by the outcomes?
Well, the UConn upset obviously, that's 111 games in a row, whatever it was. That's unbelievable. And then it was by a team that they beat by 60 points the year before. Holy mackerel. That was unbelievable. And I just love that the final shot by that 5'5" girl. That's the kind of thing that makes us love sports.
You know, I was thinking about that because you talk about one and dones in the book, the UConn team was really a freshman team of kind of first year people. But you talk a little bit about the NCAA rules on players, coming in as freshmen and then just leaving once their freshman year is over. And John Calipari comes into the discussion here at Wisconsin. Pretty much our players are all seniors when they're the main players. They stay the whole 4 years. And it's an interesting, a whole interesting approach. The differences between, just getting McDonald's All-Americans for a year versus having players with you for 4 years or 5 years.
Yeah, that's true. Some teams have won, like Duke, and Calipari with one and done players, and yet on the other hand, these are guys who are in their filling out periods, and they're not the players they're going to be. So 2, 3, 4 years down the line, they're better, even if they weren't the prize players as a freshman. Now, the way really to solve that is what Roy Williams did in North Carolina this year, which is he had the best of both worlds. He had 5 McDonald's All-Americans, and they kept them from going pro after a year. So he not only got the best players, but he kept them around. And so it's no surprise he had such a great team. Now, how you do that or whether that was just sort of random, is hard to know. But, clearly Roy Williams, Krzyzewski, everybody goes after the best players, the McDonald All-Americans. And the ones who are the best of those and have the best freshman seasons are almost certainly going to go pro.
Yeah. I think the fact that they lost last year may have had something to do with those guys hanging around for another year.
Right. That's a good point. Yes. Yeah, if Jenkins' shot had hit off the back rim like Gordon Haywood's 6 or 7 years ago in the Duke Butler game, some of those guys might have left.
What are your thoughts on student athletes? There's been a lot of more than an average amount of controversy in college sports lately. What are your thoughts on student athletes?
Well, you know, that's a complicated thing, of course. But if I could turn that a little bit to the one-and-done issue, which is a related issue, let me just put forth two ideas. One is the one-and-done rule is one of the few areas I can think of in which other people decide what's best for you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are other areas like that, but we usually rebel against that. We usually say, you know what, I can decide what's best for me. So the idea that the colleges and the NCAA and the NBA kind of get together and say, you know what, you should stay in college for 1 year, but not more or not less, rather than, you know, you should get together with your advisors and your mom and dad and your college coach and whoever else advises you and let you decide what's best for you, strikes me as really extremely paternalistic and unwarranted. The second point about the one-and-done rule is that whenever a player, and this happens a lot, leaves after a year and goes to the NBA and doesn't do that well, you hear all this uproar that, oh, what a mistake it was. He turned, you know, he would have been a better player if he stayed in college. And that really is arguing by the result only. There isn't the slightest bit of evidence that the guys who didn't make it in the NBA would have made it had they stayed in college. Staying in college doesn't make you a better player than going in the NBA. In fact, if you compare, you know, the variables of staying in college versus the NBA, who you're playing against, how many games you play, how good the coaching staff is, how good the doctor is in the training session and the nutritionist is.
Pace of play.
Everything would favor going to the NBA or to an NBA development league. So there's really no way of there's no way of knowing whether staying in college or going to the NBA makes a better player 4 years from now. But what I suspect is that the guys who are going to make it in the NBA make it whether they leave after 1 year or 4 years, and the guys who aren't going to make it in the NBA don't make it whether they stay in college 1 year or 4 years. And there's kind of an interesting corollary to this, something that we forget, which is that I think it was about 10 years ago, there was an article, I think in Sports Illustrated, by one of their basketball writers, asking, what's wrong with Krzyzewski? Why do his players flame out in the NBA so much? And they took a look at guys like Christian Laettner and Bobby Hurley, who got injured, Mark Allery, Johnny Dawkins. And they were okay NBA players, but they all stayed 4 years in Duke. They were great college players, and none of them succeeded to their really, you know, high expectations that they had based on what they did in college. So the writer was asking, how come K's players don't do well in the NBA, which is the exact opposite of what we hear now, which is, oh my goodness, you shouldn't go to the NBA. You should stay 4 years with a guy like Krzyzewski.
Tim in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I remember when I was younger hearing a story about an interview with Ted Williams as he was later in age, and he was asked basically how he'd think he would do against modern pitchers, and he said he would bat something like 3-something. And they were kind of shocked, saying, why so low? And he said, well, I'm such and such years old. I'm wondering if you can add any details to that and any credence to that that interview.
I think that might have happened in Sports Illustrated.
Yeah. I mean, I think that statement has been attributed to several people in several sports. And it's equally part funny and part insightful every time that it's said. because Ted Williams was, an unbelievable, unbelievable hitter. Who knows what he'd hit today, but he'd be great.
There's no doubt about that. He'd still be the best or one of the best, certainly, hitters.
He might not hit 400, but he'd be great.
Yeah. Do you, Mark in Chippewa Falls wonders what you think of Michael Phelps' streak versus Joe DiMaggio.
Wow. Well, what is he referring to exactly?
Well, you know, is the streak better? Is Michael Phelps' streak better than Joe DiMaggio's?
Boy, I mean, I can't say I'm an expert on swimming and one of the issues I have with sports like swimming is, and I really don't want to make much of this because it's a carping point. It's really very trivial, but you know it's not routinely accessible to great athletes all around the world in the way that some of the other sports are. But, you know, Michael Phelps is unbelievable. I mean, first of all, he's got an unbelievable body. It's like it was designed in a lab for swimming. And then his durability of winning over, out of 16 years, is it? Four
yeah.
different Olympics. Just the ability to keep his interest in it that long. And then the personal troubles that he's overcome. I mean, I have nothing but great, and I don't think anyone can have anything but great respect for Michael Phelps.
Of all of the sports truths that you looked at, Sheldon Hirsch, what's the one that was kind of most interesting to you?
Oh, wow. Well, the DiMaggio one, in the sense of how well known it is, the reach. But I'll tell you the one I found, I don't know if it's most interesting, but kind of cutest in a way, was one about LeBron James.
Hmm.
And that had to do with his relationship with Dwayne Wade. And it's in an essay that I titled, sort of tongue-in-cheek, LeBron in Love. And what it was about was, most proximately, somebody wrote an article asking Wade's wife, an actress, Gabrielle Union, about their relationship. And she was specifically asked whether they said, "I love you" to each other. And it turned out that they do. And that came into play when, not this season, but last season, LeBron and Dwayne Wade practiced together on an off day. And Charles Barkley and Kenny Smith and Michael Jordan and all the NBA greats went crazy. They said, "How do you practice with an opponent? You know," they said, we hated our opponents. We only wanted to kill our opponents. We would never do anything like that." It kind of was a imitation of what they said when LeBron left to Miami. But anyway, so I started thinking about that, about how Barkley and Jordan and all these guys said all they ever did was hate their opponents, and this was unprecedented. And I realized that back in the day, the two greatest, most famous NBA players ever, Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell, had a bromance.
Were great, great friends. And
great,
you know,
friends.
What?
They had sleepovers the night before games. They played. Will wrote that he would go to Russell's house the day before a game, have dinner, and they'd play Lionel Trains together.
On that note, Sheldon, we have to go. There's so much more in your book. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Sheldon Hirsch, author of Hot Hands, Draft Hype, DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths, our guest on the Ideas Network.